pass the baskets, I'm going to start in with a little story. An old man lived in a small village. He was the poorest man in the village, but he owned a beautiful white stallion. In fact, this stallion was so beautiful, the king had offered him a fortune to buy it from him, but he decided not to sell. Well, after a really harsh winter, during which the old man and his family nearly starved, the townspeople came to visit. They said, "Old man, you can hardly afford to feed your family. Sell the stallion and you'll be rich. If you don't, you're a fool." "It's too early to tell," replied the old man. A few months later, the old man woke up to find that the white stallion had run away. Once again, the townspeople came and they said, "You know, if you had sold your horse, you'd be rich. Now you have nothing. You're a fool." "It's too early to tell," the old man replied. 2 weeks later, the white stallion returned, and along with it came three other white stallions. "Old man," the townspeople said, "we are the fools. You can sell the stallion to the king now and still have three left. You are smart." "It's too early to tell," said the old man. The following week, the man's son, his only son, was breaking in one of the stallions and was thrown from the horse and broke both of his legs. The townspeople paid a visit to the old man. They said, "Old man, if you had just sold the stallion, you'd be rich and your son would not be crippled. You know, you're a fool." "It's too early to tell," replied the old man. The next month, war broke out with the neighboring village. All the young men in the village went off to the war and all were killed. The townspeople came and they cried out to the old man, "We've lost our sons. You're the only one who hasn't lost his son. If you'd sold your stallion to the king, your son too would be dead. You are so smart." "It's too early to tell," replied the old man. Now, what's the point of this story? Whenever something good or bad comes into your life, somebody is immediately going to come along and they're going to try to attach some value to that. Whether good or bad, they're going to try to attach meaning or explanation to it. They might condemn and blame you and say, "Oh, it's all your fault." Or they might praise you if it's something good, or maybe envy you for your good luck. But no one, except for God, knows the ultimate outcome. It is always too early to tell. The bad or painful circumstance that people are calling you a fool about, or that they're you know, sad about, or whatever, that might help you to learn and grow, and ultimately you're blessed as a result. And the apparent good fortune that everybody envies you for might end up destroying your life. You can't measure the impact in the short term, and so you have to trust God, who is in control of all things. And when we understand this, then we become wise. Look at Ephesians 5:14. It says, "Wake up, sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Be very careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the Lord's will is." Now, the Apostle Paul is writing this, and he gives some clear instructions. He says, first, wake up and live wisely. He tells Christians here, wake up, you sleepy heads. If you've been asleep spiritually, if you've been dead spiritually, if you haven't been paying attention to what's going on in the world around you, then wake up, sleeper, and start to live wisely, because the days are evil. And this could not be any more true for us today. Our society is going through so many rapid changes. Nobody can even guess where we'll be 5 years or 10 years from now, except that the trend is not a very good one. Morally, economically, spiritually, the trends in the U.S. are not very good right now. So how do we deal with this? How do we live wisely in a society like this? Well, in the 12th chapter of 1 Chronicles, it tells about when David was just becoming king. And he had all these people coming to him from all parts of the kingdom, from the different tribes in the kingdom, coming to ally themselves with David to make him their king. Listen to what it says about some of these different people. It says, "There were men of Simeon, warriors, ready for battle. Men of Ephraim, brave warriors, men of Zebulun, experienced soldiers, men of Dan, ready for battle, men of Asher, experienced soldiers. All sound about the same, right? But in verse 32, it says, men of Issachar, who understood the times and knew what Israel should do. It helps to have a strong army, but it helps even more if you understand the times and know what to do with that army, know the right thing to do. We've got a strong army in the U.S., but some would argue that maybe we don't know the right way to use it. We haven't been all that successful in some of our recent wars and efforts, and you know, some of the countries don't end up better off like we had hoped. You know, there's a lot of argument about that. If you don't understand the times, you can't live wisely, and you're not going to have a clue about how to deal with the changes in life that are happening all around us. A few years ago, Judge Robert Bork was being interviewed on Face the Nation. The interviewer mentioned a number of depressing events going on at the time, political scandals and crime and decline in morals, you name it. And then the interviewer threw up his hands and he says, I don't understand what's going on. Do you? Judge Bork said, yes, I do. We are on the edge of the decline of Western civilization. Now, whether you believe that or not, there are huge changes going on in our society, and we need to try to understand the times. Now, I can't teach you in 5 minutes how to understand the times, and that's assuming that I even understand them. But what I can teach is there's a couple things about our society that I do understand that affect everything else. First of all, we're living in the time when the U.S. is facing several great spiritual battles in our society. The first is a battle between belief or rejection of a personal, loving God. You see, almost everybody believes in God. Statistics say 96% now. If you go out on the street and ask people if they believe in God, 96% of the time they say, oh yeah, I believe in God. And their answer will mean completely nothing. Because they don't believe necessarily in a personal, loving God who's involved in every detail of our lives, who knows everything about us and wants to have a personal relationship with us. They don't believe in a God who has a good plan for our lives, who sent his own son to die for us and to pay for our sins, and who, as a result, expects us to live for him, obey him, and put him as our number one priority in life. They don't believe in that kind of God. That kind of belief in God is actually getting more and more unpopular. The kind of God that most people believe in is the kind of God that will tolerate anything and never hold anybody accountable. And he doesn't really care about sin in our lives. He kind of just winks at it unless it's really bad. And, of course, God never really gets involved personally in the lives of people. He's just sort of up there watching from a distance, right? That's the kind of people or the kind of God that most people in society believe in. And of course, if you make the claim that Jesus is the only way to a relationship with God, you're going to be accused of intolerance and being narrow-minded. If you claim that God wants us to live holy lives and, for example, practice sex only within marriage relationship as the Bible commands, you know, you are so out of touch. You're intolerant, you're judgmental. You see, we're living in a time when there's a battle between belief or rejection of a personal, loving God. And if somebody tells you that they're a Christian or they believe in God, don't assume that they believe in a personal, loving God. Don't assume that they have a relationship with him. Because there's a battle on. You need to understand the times. There's another battle going on today between absolute truth and situational ethics. Most people in our society would say, well, there is no absolute truth. My truth can be different from your truth, and my morals can be different from your morals, and as long as you don't hurt anybody, it's okay. There's a philosophy professor named Roger Wengert at the University of Illinois who teaches an ethics class. And at the beginning of the first class of every ethics class, he starts by asking how many of the students believe that truth is relative. And typically, three-fourths of the students raise their hands, yes, we believe that truth is relative, there's no absolute standard of truth. Well, after discussing the syllabus and the testing dates and the papers and the content of the course, he then gets to the grading policies, and he informs the class that they will be graded based on height. And after the smart aleck tall kid inevitably says, oh yeah, right, and he says, short kids will receive A's, tall kids will receive D's. The students immediately object, well, that's not fair. He says, well, I'm the professor. I get to decide how to grade however I want. And the students go on to it and says, well, you know, what you ought to do is grade according to how we learn the content of the course. And you ought to, you know, look at our test papers and our exams and you know, the papers we write. And you know, you ought to use those to grade us from. And Professor Wengert then replies, he says, if you really believe that all truth is relative, then you wouldn't even use words like ought and should. You'd realize that there is no external standard to which my grading should conform. I can grade however I like because truth is relative. And what he's trying to show those students is that we all want truth to be relative when it's convenient for me, right? You know, when I want to, you know, decide my own thing and do my own thing, then I want truth to be relative so I can do whatever I feel like, right? So we all like that. But the rest of the time, and especially with other people, we don't want truth to be relative. We want there to be a standard by which we can live because, you know, like when my boss is deciding who gets a pay raise, I want there to be a standard so that I make sure that I get treated fairly and not have him just making up his own truth about whoever he wants to give a raise to. You know, that, no, we want standards in place. When John Quincy Adams was president of the United States, he stood before Congress and he held up two bushel baskets, one from New York, one from South Carolina. He said, the problem with these is that one of them holds 68 cubic inches more than the other. And then he held up 2 1-pound weights, one from Massachusetts, one from Maine. He said, the problem is that one weighs an ounce more than the other. He said, gentlemen, we need a standard. And as a result, the House Weights and Measurements Committee was formed. And today in Washington, D.C., they have a set of scales that's so accurate that people aren't allowed within 10 feet of it because body temperature will affect the weight, the accuracy of the scale. And as a result, 1 pound is the same as in Ohio as it is in Oklahoma. A bushel is the same in Mississippi as it is in Montana because we now have a standard by which we can measure everything. It's because President Adams knew we needed absolute standards in order to measure. The same is true of our spiritual lives. We need a standard, and our standard is Jesus Christ. In fact, when you look at Jesus, you can hear God saying, this is the standard, this is what I had in mind when I created you. You are to be like Jesus Christ. In Acts 17:30, Paul says, God overlooked people's ignorance about these things in earlier times, but now he commands everyone everywhere to repent of their sins and turn to him, for he has set a day for judging the world with justice by the man he has appointed. And he proved to everyone who this is by raising him from the dead. So it says God will judge the world by Jesus. If you want to know what the standard of judgment is going to be on the judgment day, there it is. The standard by which we'll be judged is Jesus Christ. We need that standard because there's a battle on about absolute truth. I read about an African tribe who discovered an easy way to catch and kill ducks on the river. They'd go upstream, they'd place a pumpkin in the river, and they'd let it float down into the middle of the flock of ducks. And at first, the ducks would all flap their wings and squawk and fly away when they saw the pumpkin. But the tribesmen were very patient, and they floated pumpkin after pumpkin down the river through the flock of ducks. And with each successive pumpkin, the ducks would become less and less frightened and more comfortable, and they finally accepted pumpkins as just a normal way of life. When the natives saw that the pumpkins no longer frightened the ducks, they hollowed out pumpkins, put them over their head, and walked into the river, and they were able to walk right into the middle of the flock of ducks, grab their legs, pull them under, one after another, and they had roast duck for dinner. Now, what's the point? There is absolute truth, but if you don't accept and follow that standard to guide your life, then you're like the foolish duck. And we eventually just start accepting pumpkins that float our way. Pumpkins are the seemingly harmless beliefs that we come across every day, that float by us every day. Things like, well, you know, Jesus isn't really the only way to God. You know, that's intolerant. You know, all religions are pretty much equal. It's a pumpkin. Or, you know, it's okay to have sex outside of marriage. You know, as long as you don't hurt anybody, everybody does that. You know, another pumpkin. Or, yeah, I know that Jesus said I have to forgive people who hurt me and love my enemy, but he didn't really expect me to do that. You know, that's too hard. That's another pumpkin. New pumpkins come floating down the river every day. Doubts about God's word and pressure to change our moral standards, pumpkin after pumpkin, they creep by. And we eventually come to the point where we just sort of ignore them. We're used to them until one day they kill us. The Bible tells us, wake up and live wisely. And then in verse 16, it tells us, make the most of every opportunity. Why? Because the days are evil. I don't know if you've noticed that. Just read the newspaper. The days are evil. In the days before modern harbors, before they were able to dredge out the passage in and out of the harbor, a ship had to wait for the flood tide in order to come into port. The term for this situation in Latin was ab portu, or meaning off port. In other words, a ship waited off port for the moment when it could ride the tide into the harbor. The crew of the ship had to be ready and waiting for that one opportunity when the tide was right, because if they missed it, then they'd have to wait until the next tide came. And the English word opportunity comes from that Latin, ab portu, waiting for the tide. Do we have any Shakespeare fans here? Anybody read Julius Caesar? There's probably one of the most famous sections that Shakespeare ever wrote, and he turned this meaning of opportunity, dealing with tides and currents, into one of this famous passage. See if you remember this from school. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Amid it, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and miseries. On such a full sea we are now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves or lose our ventures. To simplify that, he's saying, if you miss your chance, you blew it. You may not get another one. You need to make the most of every opportunity. Well, why do we need to make the most of every opportunity? Because if we're wise, we realize that our lives are short. Our time is very limited. James 4 tells us, now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. The Bible tells us not to count on tomorrow because we don't know if we'll have a tomorrow. I don't have a guarantee of even one more day of my life. We need to seize the day because our time is limited. I saw an article titled, if you're 35, you have 500 days to live. The article said that when you subtract the time that you spend sleeping and working, tending to personal matters, eating, personal hygiene, traveling, doing chores, and all the other miscellaneous time stealers, then in the next 40 years, you only have 500 days to spend doing what you really want. So what are you going to do with your 500 days? A poet put it this way, just a tiny little minute, only 60 seconds in it. Forced upon me, can't refuse it. Didn't seek it, didn't choose it. I must suffer if I lose it. Give account if I abuse it. Just a tiny little minute, but eternity is in it. You probably remember that about a year ago, Steve Jobs died, the founder of Apple. Let me read you something he said. Before his death, obviously. He said, when I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, if you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right. It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I've looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer had been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. If today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? You know, it's interesting. When you study the Bible, you don't find a lot of emphasis on saving time or managing your time well. We live in such a time-conscious society. That's all that we talk about. You know, we're trying to fit as much as we can in every day. We're rushing around. But God never tells us that we have to be great time managers. But he does call us to be great opportunity managers. It's not just time that matters. It's really timing. It's not just counting the minutes and hours and days and weeks and months and years. It's making the minutes and hours and days and months and years count. You can have your schedule packed 24 hours a day and still miss doing the things that really count. And tomorrow you'll get 24 more hours to work with, but you may never get back the opportunities that you missed today. Sometimes you miss your chance, you don't get another one. So what does it mean to make the most of every opportunity? Let's look at a Bible story, Luke 10. You're all familiar with this one. Jesus went to the home of Mary and Martha. He sits down in the living room to teach. Mary's sitting at his feet, soaking in every word. Martha's in the kitchen making dinner. And Martha gets upset because Mary's not helping her fix dinner. And so she says in Luke 10:40, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." You see, Martha was so preoccupied with all the things she needed to do, she didn't realize God is sitting in her living room. You and I do the same thing all the time. We get so caught up in the here and now, we let spiritual opportunities go right on by us. Things that would make an eternal difference in somebody's life. Things which would last forever. And we say, "Well, I don't have time. You know, I got to hurry because my show's on TV." Richard Swenson is a medical doctor who wrote a book called Margin. He talks about stress and anxiety. He basically concludes that people today are plain overloaded. And he says we're overloaded in three areas. He says, first, we're overloaded with commitments. We try to pack way too much into our days, and we don't make the hard decisions about what not to do. He says, second, we're overloaded with possessions. Our closets are full, our garages are crammed, and now we spend all our time cleaning and maintaining and caring for and worrying about all our stuff. And thirdly, we're overloaded in our work. We get up early, we fight traffic, we work long hours, and we have to because we got to pay for all the stuff we bought. And what's the result of all this? Because of our lives are overloaded, a lot of us play the little game of, "I wish it were. I wish it were Friday because I'm so stressed out. You know, I can't wait for the weekend. I wish it were next week. I wish it were next month. I wish it were next year." It's like the girl who went to college and she hated all the college work, but she told herself, "If I could just, you know, get done with college, then I'll get married and have some kids, and then I can start to enjoy life." So she stuck with it. She went to classes and finally graduated from college. And sure enough, she got married, had some kids. And then she discovered that children are a lot of work. And they're really frustrating sometimes. And, you know, this is harder than college. You know, and so she told herself, "If I can just get these kids raised, then I'll be able to relax and enjoy life." Well, about the time the kids were entering high school, her husband came to her and said, "You know, we're not going to have money to pay for their college. And so I think you really need to get a job." And she didn't want to get a job, but she said, you know, you're right, I guess we do need to pay for that. And so she got a job, and she went to work, and she didn't like it, but she knew she needed the money. And she told herself, I could just get these kids out of college and the bills paid for, then I could quit work, and then I can really enjoy life. Finally, the last child graduated from college, all the bills were paid. She walked into her employer's office and said, I quit. And he said, oh, no, you don't want to quit now. If you just work 8 more years, you'll have a pension for the rest of your life. And she didn't want to keep working, but she said, well, yeah, you're right. I hate to give up that pension. And so she kept working and another 8 years. And finally, she and her husband both retired together. They sold their home, bought a little retirement condo. And then they sat down on the swing on their porch, got out the picture album, and dreamed about the good old days. You know, that's sort of funny, but at the same time, it scares me. Because I don't want that to happen to me. You know? Somebody said that life is what happens to you while you're making plans to do something else. Sometimes I can get so wrapped up in trying to make everything, you know, work so well right now that I realize I'm living without any joy or any peace in life. I'm not satisfied with where I am. You ever felt like that? Have you been making the most of every opportunity that God sends your way to do things that will last for eternity? You know, maybe it's as simple as a friend who wants to talk and you make time instead of rushing off to something else. Maybe it's a chance to help out somebody in need. Maybe it's you're talking to somebody about Jesus or inviting them to church. Let me give you an example that impacted my life. After my junior year of college at the Naval Academy, I was taking a summer school class, and so I was going to be there for 3 months without a whole lot to do. And a man I knew from my church in Annapolis named Bob Underhill heard that I was going to be around for the summer, and he knew that I liked to weightlift at the time. You wouldn't know it now, but I used to be really buff. Six-pack and everything, believe me. Ask Kathy. She knew me when I was young. But anyway, I didn't mean to say all that. So he asked me if we could weightlift together during the summer. I said, yeah, great. And so he came over 3 times a week, and we would weightlift for an hour and a half. I mean, we were serious. We not just this 30-minute thing or something. Hour and a half, 3 times a week. And at first, I wasn't sure why this guy that I really respected and admired from the church, why he would want to spend all that time with me. And then I realized that every time we weightlifted, we'd get into these discussions on deep spiritual things, and you know, it's like, wow, you know, I'm learning a lot. And then I figured out that wasn't by chance. You see, he was making a long-term investment in me. He was building my faith. He was sharing with me what it meant to be a godly man, sharing some of his wisdom with me. And he was willing to invest about 5 hours a week in a kid that he would never see again. Except that he did see me again, because I went back to the Naval Academy for my 30th reunion a couple years ago. And so this is like 31 years after the last time I saw him. And he was there. He came as a guest of another midshipman who he had also invested his life and time in. And I went up to him, and I introduced myself. I said, Bob, you probably don't understand, probably don't remember me, but you made a huge difference in my life 31 years ago. Huge difference. And I could tell that he didn't really remember me, but I didn't care about that. What I cared about was the fact that I wanted to show my thanks for him taking the opportunity to make a difference that would last for eternity. That he would not just walk on by, that he would not say, you know what, I'm pretty busy. I don't really have the time for that, you know, for this kid that I'll never see again. He made the most of that opportunity. Are you making the most of your opportunities? How are you handling this precious gift of time that God has given you? Do you let yourself become overloaded with all the day-to-day stuff so you don't even have time to look past your schedule? Or are you focusing on the opportunities that God brings by in your life all the time. The Apostle Paul tells us, make the most of every opportunity because the days are evil. And then in verse 17 he says, therefore do not be foolish, but understand what the Lord's will is. That's his third instruction for us, understand the Lord's will. Now everybody wants to know God's will for them. I've never met anybody who wasn't at least a little concerned about knowing God's will. But you know, a lot of people look at it as sort of a big mystery. You know, it's kind of a dark cloud. Every once in a while we get a little peek behind the cloud and we can see a little bit of God's will. But most of the time, you know, we don't really have a clue. I don't think it's really that difficult. In fact, let's watch a quick video.
I feel uptight. I feel all this intense pressure squeezing in on me. I feel like I'm trapped and don't know where to go. I have no direction. What exactly is God's will for me? Why can't I find it? Why is this so hard? Why is God's will like this magical dangling carrot that I can never seem to catch? We often make it harder than it is. Maybe it's because we confuse God's will with my will. We get impatient. We try to pigeonhole the omnipotent creator of the universe to fix us, heal us, help us, and bless us by begging him, or raising our voice to him, or bargaining with him, everything but saying, your will be done. Not mine. See, we've confused our role in this epic story that's unfolding in front of us. It's not about me, it's about him. I'm not the star of this movie, he is. I've just got a small cameo in this beautiful love story about truth and redemption. That takes the burden off of me. I can focus on making Jesus famous and living a life that points the spotlight to him. I feel better now. I can breathe again.
Sometimes it's a lot more simple than you think. I can simply focus on making Jesus famous and living a life that points the spotlight to him. That's about as hard as it really gets. Let me close with one last verse which summarizes what I've been saying this morning. Romans chapter 13 says, the hour has come for you to wake up from your slumber, because our salvation is nearer now than when we first believed. The night is nearly over. The day is almost here. So let us put aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. If you've been asleep at the wheel spiritually, it's time to wake up. We need to understand the times and understand that God put us here for a purpose. We need to live wisely. We need to make the most of every opportunity that God brings along and start living to make Jesus famous. Let's stand for prayer. I'd like the worship band to come up for a closing song. And let's bow together. God, would you reveal to us, to each one of us here, areas where we've been led astray, that we haven't followed your standard, we haven't been living wisely. And show us what to do and how to make the most of every opportunity that you bring our way. Would you show us the area of our lives where we need to make changes in how we spend our time so we have the time to do what will last for eternity? And help us to understand your will as it applies to our lives. Jesus, we want to make you famous. We want to live lives that will point the spotlight to you. And this morning, if there's anyone here and you're not sure you have a relationship with God right now, you can make it make sure right now. Just pray along with me something like this. God will hear you in your heart. Just say, dear God, I realize that I do need you. I realize that you are a personal, loving God who wants to be involved in every part of my life. And so, Lord, I say yes to you. I say yes to that relationship. I ask you to show me what it means and how to start. Lord, I thank you for the forgiveness that you've given me through Jesus Christ dying on the cross. And I thank you for the new life that I can have because of the perfect life that he lived. So I ask you to come into my heart, Give me the power and the strength to serve you. Put your Holy Spirit in me. I say yes to you today. Amen.